CliffCentral.com.
Ndangwa Noyo is an author. He's written a book called The Wrong Things About Africa, which I think you'll find as interesting as I did. Ndangwa is a Zambian. He's lectured at universities all over the continent. He's currently in South Africa, and he holds a PhD from the University of Witwatersrand, M in philosophy from the University of Cambridge. It's a master's, and a BSW from the University of Zambia. He was also a postdoctoral fellow at the Fondation Maison des Sciences de l'Homme in Paris, France, between 2005 to 2006. Is that all right? Did my pronunciation work well enough?
Brilliant.
Well, listen, it's a pleasure to meet you. I read your book the other night, and I have to say, as an African, it's sometimes tough for us to face up to the shortcomings of our own leaders and our own continent post-colonialization and independence. You know, it's not hard for people to find fault with what came before because it was so clearly and conscionably wrong. And there were so many very crass, basic inequalities. There was such a disrespect for human rights. But we don't have to go over that territory as much because there are enough people still talking about it.
Yes, yes.
What I was amazed by in your book is the focus on the uncomfortable realities of what's happened since colonialization and independence. And this is not stuff that will win you massive support from Pan-Africanists. It will not win you much support from the left.
Yes, yes.
They don't like the arguments and the facts that you proffer because it doesn't help their argument that all the evil ended once independence started.
Definitely.
And that all the bad things went away as soon as the colonialists were chased out. We've had so much to deal with in various parts of this continent since each of our nations became independent.
Independent, yes.
Including in South Africa. You can call our independence 1994, really. So we might be the youngest in many ways. Obviously, South Sudan has just come out of its own kind of independence. But there are, you know, in sub-Saharan Africa alone, there are countless examples of countries that really had a bright hope for the future. And that future has largely been quashed by greedy and inept leaders and systems that are not necessarily working for the people who live in those countries. Is that a rough synopsis of the kind of projection of your book?
More or less, more or less. And thank you very much for inviting me to your show. I'm most grateful.
Yeah,
and I would like to just start from the point of view of looking ourselves in the mirror. That more often than not, we African people, and during, you know, the post-colonial era, we have almost sought to shift the blame to the otherness, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Shifting the blame to the colonial master who packed his bags and left five decades ago. Shifting the blame to some faceless enemies of the state. Shifting the blame to the weather or anything under the sun. And for me, it became quite a very tedious type of existence in Africa, being an African, growing up on the continent, and growing up at a time when Africa was on the rise, not this narrative that they're giving us, that Africa is on the rise, when most of the countries are not able to even meet the basic needs of their citizens, when most of the infrastructure is non-existence, when health infrastructure is non-existence, existent in most parts of the continent. So for me, this sob story of that Africa is on the rise just because we have got 6% GDP in Angola or 7% GDP and certain projections around the economic management of the continent's countries, to tell us that things are going right and we should be patting ourselves on the backs, I think that narrative needs to be just put on the back burner and let us look ourselves in the mirror squarely.
Now, that's such an uncomfortable thing to do.
For some. But I come from a generation where we, as young people, because I come from Zambia, as you rightly pointed out, we had lived in a prosperous Zambia in the 1970s, going to good schools, being afforded a good life before Kaunda became a dictator, because the founding president of Zambia, Kenneth Kaunda, was given a platform of raising the quality of life of the people after independence that was based on a constitutional democracy. Now, the constitutional democracy had allowed for multi-party engagements, had allowed for multi-party politics and contestations. We have got 73 ethnic groups in Zambia. And so it was a time whereby you could see that he and his colleagues had engaged themselves quite nicely and quite positively in raising the quality of life of the people. So there were progressive policies that were passed. I mean, I am a product of free education. I wouldn't have gone to Cambridge with my suitcase. Nobody knew me there.
Yeah.
But because of the foundation that I had, the type of education I had, which was free, but highly, I would say, high quality type of education, I ended up going to Cambridge. And that must be acknowledged of Kaunda.
In other words, you could compete with the best of the world.
Absolutely. We had good teachers. We had good syllabi and we had good curricula that allowed us to understand who we were as Africans first and then as Zambians secondly and then as citizens of the world. Mm-hmm. So we could hold our own with anybody across the continent, across the globe.
But this sounds amazing. So how did it go wrong?
Yes. And I was going to get to that. So you have a constitutional democracy.
We don't even have free education necessarily.
Up to now. And, you know, and these are some of the issues that I raise even in our class sessions or conferences that South Africa still needs to transform to a point whereby the high quality education only last year where the young people now are challenging and raising the bar of contestation and saying we need free high quality education,
right.
which can be done.
It can be done. Absolutely.
It's not rocket science at all. Now, 1972 for us was a watershed in Zambia because Kenneth Kaunda began to see that his power was slipping away and the United National Independence Party, the party of independence, the party that brought freedom to the people, so to speak, quote unquote, was that it began to have dictatorial tendencies. And Kaunda began to be the overriding Tsar of Zambia. And so the constitution was changed. And a one-party so-called participatory democracy was put in place in December 1972. And hence, and therefore, after that, multi-party politics were banned. And for 17 years, Zambians lived under one-party state dictatorship. So you had one party. Only members of that party could be articulating an agenda for the country.
But what about those people who say, let's just be philosophers for a while. So the ANC might say in South Africa, but actually if we were the one-party state, inside the ANC you have plenty of disagreement, plenty of diversity of opinion. So why couldn't a one-party state work? It works in China, they say. They say it works in Venezuela. They say that these are places where a one-party state is quite effective. I mean, we know what's happened in Venezuela.
Absolutely.
But in Zambia, why couldn't it have worked? Was the party of Kaunda a monolithic party that basically did the bidding of the man at the top?
Yes, Kaunda was actually the prime mover of anything that happened in that society for a long time. And the one-party dictatorships, and this is something that I've got to raise, they begin to suck the life out of civil society. They begin to stifle critical engagements in regard to what people want for their own country. So you begin to toe a certain line. You have to think the same. And that's why it was easy for Kaunda and the UNIP regime to be in sync with China. At that time, the Chinese, well, this is a different China that we're having now. In the 1970s, every Chinese wore a uniform. And this was a country we used to say that China, as we were growing up, that everyone rode a bicycle in China. And so it took time for the Chinese to get where they are today because they had to open up spaces within their political system. So you have a system that begins to allow corruption, nepotism, to take on, you know, national proportion and get entrenched and begin to be institutionalized in such a way that if you do not ascribe to the president's warped ideas about society, then you become an enemy of the state.
Yeah.
So we cannot be all the same. Even in families, you've got diversity.
Right.
You know, your mother, your father will have different views. Your siblings will have different views. But in a one-party state dictatorship, you're expected to think alike. You're expected to march, as I found the ANC using that that same phrase, I hate it, toe the line, party line. And what made things very difficult in Zambia at the time was that the party was supreme. It was not the government. So it was the party and its government. So you had bureaucrats having to implement policies that were conjured up or even dreamed about or just whimsically pulled out of the hat by politicians overnight and say, look, you guys, you are the bureaucrats, implement this.
And where usually those policies would favor the party rather than the state.
Yes, they were populist. Mm-hmm. And more often than not, they were actually disastrous even in the medium to the long term. But, a kissing point of that is the nationalization of the copper mines in Zambia. And that's one of the issues that began to make the country go down a path of disastrous.
But let's pause here for a moment because there's a lot of stuff that I think South Africa is grappling with at the moment that Zambia's already dealt with.
We have gone through that, yes. Right. The romanticism.
Let's talk about populism for a start, because you said that the party, in order to grow and to maintain its influence and to expand its influence over society, it would implement populist ideas.
Yes.
Like, for example, nationalizing of mines, which we know is one of the things...
highly impractical.
Okay, but why is populism bad?
Populism can only be good to a certain extent when you look at the practicalities in terms of the instruments that you have at your disposal as political actors in fulfilling the mandate of meeting the needs of the people and the aspirations of the people. Bottom line is, the fact of the matter is that we as people come into public spaces and public office in order to, you know, raise the agenda, not from a personal point of view, but at a national level, and take it forward. Driving the country's agenda for the people. Why? Because we find that in society, not everybody has got the ability to stand up and galvanize a whole group of people and match them in the direction of national progressive
Are you saying that sometimes populist policies, although they may be popular, they don't necessarily achieve the goal the population needs achieved? Are you saying they don't know what they want?
Well, more often than not, it's just, you know, they're short-sighted, I would say, in the sense that you want to gratify certain sections of society in order to meet a certain objective, usually, which is selfish, I would say. And therefore, the end result usually begins to show that this was a disastrous route that we took as a people. So you want to have something that is so excitable to the masses. Tomorrow, everybody is going to have houses. Like what happened in Zambia when Michael Sata came into power. He says in 90 days, everybody is going to have a house and everybody's cheering. In 90 days, everything was in 90 days is going to have a job. Your pockets will be full of money in 90 days. People want to hear such things. But now let's take a look at the nuts and bolts of achieving those houses within 90 days, for example. It's practically impossible. So populist agendas, especially in a post-colonial Africa, I would say are very, very dangerous. Populism worked in the anti-colonial struggle. Mm-hmm. You need rhetoric to challenge a very powerful,
regime.
You know, so pound to pound.
An oppressive one. Yeah.
Absolutely. So what happened with the ANC, for example? I mean, I'll tell you, I grew up with the ANC. We saw the ANC in Zambia and we supported the ANC as youngsters. And we went to school with the children of most of these guys who are in power right now in Lusaka, because I grew up in Lusaka, Zambia. And we were bombed by the South African Air Force, and it was not a joke.
You guys paid a price for your association.
Whether we talk about lives being lost, whether we talk about infrastructure being lost, economic opportunities being lost, whether we talk about business opportunities being lost, and the money that we as Zambians poured into the liberation struggle, plus or minus, comes to about $19 billion.
Now, did you get just a return on that investment?
No, we're just being called makwere kwere.
Well, this is,
I mean, jokes aside, but
no. But here's the thing: while we're on Zambia, because there's a lot we need to discuss and unpack here, and you're the guy to talk about it, because I actually haven't had a discussion with someone who is as conversant in Zambian politics as you are for a long time. So Kenneth Kaunda is widely regaled by the ANC as a hero.
Which is
because he helped them during the struggle. Without a doubt, that was absolutely one of the things he must be given credit for.
And I want to qualify that point, which I raise every time I'm in such public discussions. Mm-hmm. Yes, Kaunda did provide not only the ANC, but Frelimo in Mozambique, MPLA. Mm-hmm. UNITA in Angola, and even parts of FNLA, ZAPU ZANU in Zimbabwe, SWAPO in Namibia.
He was like the godfather.
So-called, but he didn't do that on his own. And that's why I'm saying Kaunda did it, because he had the Zambian people backing him. It was a Zambian project. You had Zambians supporting it. Even at the individual and community level, you had Zambians investing their energies into the liberation struggle. If we as citizens had said, no, we are tired of these foreigners, the support for the liberation movement would have been futile.
And yet we now find ourselves in a situation where, because people like to be binary,
yes,
they see Kaunda as a good guy.
Yes.
And they're unable to see his faults.
Many of them, actually. And some of the issues that if I have found myself raising the profile, the dark side, I don't want to use the dark side, because everything that is black is bad. Let's say the nefarious side of Kenneth Kaunda. When I raise it in South Africa, everybody goes,
It's like sacrilege.
I know, how do you say that? He was a dictator, yes, definitely. But I always tell people there are three facets to Kaunda's regime and Kaunda's rule. Mm-hmm. There was the good part that I mentioned, where he and his colleagues put firmly a solid platform for a new Zambia, where there was manufacturing industries were created. Mm-hmm. Mind you, that is the first decade of independence when Zambia was still a multi-party state.
Right.
It is not by accident or coincidental that so many things happened in that decade. Afterwards, nothing happened. You see, it was about the party.
Things went into decline.
Absolutely.
Because the first part was the solid base.
Solid base. Schools were built. Universities were built. Some of the policies. If you look at the first cabinet of Zambia to date, it was the most highly educated, because at the time of independence, when UNIP went and had a conference in Magoye, we're talking about 24th of October, when 1964, when Zambia got independence. Just prior to that, they had a UNIP extraordinary congress in Magoye in Southern Province, where they met and deliberated as to what type of cabinet they wanted.
And you need a new
Zambia.
And you need your smartest people to figure that
stuff
out. Yes,
and that's what they did. Right. We had also the most diverse, cabinet. We had biracial ministers such as Mr. Aaron Milner. Mm-hmm. We had a white British minister,
Didn't you just recently have a white guy in charge?
Oh, well.
For a short while.
For a short while, like, guy squat. Yeah, but he's a Zambian. I mean, in Zambia, yeah, it's not, but for us, it's not a big deal.
I know, but it was curious.
Yeah, and, everybody was, Africa, it was like, wow.
We're so obsessed with race in this country because of the divisions of our past.
Guy squat is a Zambian. I mean,
Okay, so that was the first facet.
That was the first
What are the other two?
So the second part is where we Zambia became, one party state. And that is the time when Kaunda also became more autocratic and became more paranoid.
Right.
And this is the time when the society was regimented, you know. And this is a time when the intelligence operatives expanded exponentially. You had special branch, you had the office of the president, who were the intelligence operators, and then you had informants who were part of that system. So every third person, I think, in my opinion, was an informant. So you go into a bar or you're chatting and you say something about Kaunda or the party, lo and behold, you'll be whisked away. So from 1972, from 1972 to early 80s, there was more entrenching of autocratic, of an autocratic rule. The regime became more intolerant to criticisms.
Yes.
And then the party became monolithic. At every level, UNIP became visible in the society. They even created vigilantes. You couldn't go to a market if you were not affiliated to the party. And if you dare say something, you'd be actually bundled up and actually, you know, physically assaulted. Yes. And because of that, the state of emergency, by the way, Kaunda ruled Zambia under a state of emergency for 27 years.
Really?
Yes. And this is something people don't know.
No. That's as long as Madiba was in prison.
Yes, exactly. For 27 years, Zambians lived under a state of emergency, which was, promulgated in 1964 when there was a rebellion by a religious sect in the northern part of Zambia by a prophetess, so to speak, known as Alice Lenshina. And so just prior to independence, we had those rumblings and the state of emergency was actually instituted because Kaunda was an interim leader of that transition government.
So he came in under a state of emergency.
Emergency. And they just kept on renewing it. And it was easy to go to parliament and say, look, the Rhodesian forces are always crossing. We need to when we arrest spies.
And the South Africans are bombing us.
And the South Africans are bombing us and the Portuguese, etc. But that was used against Zambians. That was used against people, for example, the people of Barrowsland, who are a part of also of Zambia. That's another narrative. Because Zambia is not just Zambia per se. Zambia,
you said there are 70-something different kind of ethnic groups.
Yes. We are many. And each and every one of us have got their own identities.
Yeah.
But there's a part of Zambia which is known as Barrowsland, which was a separate territory, colonial territory. Zambia is actually an amalgamation of Barrowsland and former Northern Rhodesia to form Zambia in 1964. So prior to Zambia becoming independent, the king of Barrowsland, Sir Monawina Liwanika, and his cabinet flew to London. And they signed a treaty at Marlborough House with UNIP and Kaunda as Prime Minister then of Northern Rhodesia to facilitate the amalgamation of Barrowsland into Zambia and to Northern Rhodesia to form the state now known as Zambia.
Geographically, where is Barrowsland?
Barrowsland is in the west. So Katimamulilo, Namibia side, like a previous
trip,
part of that all the way to, so it's in the western part of Zambia.
Okay.
And it was a kingdom that facilitated the writing up of treaties that actually paved the way later, decades later, for the independence. Because the same treaties that King Liwanika signed with the agents of British colonial rule, Cecil Rhodes, British South African company, ended up being the bargaining chips at the Lancaster talks after the signing of the Barroso-Slum Agreement.
What was the third phase of Kaunda's rule?
The third phase was the most bizarre phase, where economic management became the privy of UNIP functionaries. So it's no longer just state repression, but it is bizarre in the sense that you have chaotic management at its best. But also you had the flip-flopping and wrong-headed policies where you couldn't stick to one political policy position, where you had to appease the masses. Now the populism comes in quite strongly.
Mm-hmm.
Where Kaunda now begins to be the godfather that you rightly mentioned, the Don, where he starts parceling out positions in order to quell dissent and raise certain people so that certain parts of Zambia are pacified. Mm-hmm. So he was playing a juggling game of chess. And so if you have a prime minister from the northwestern province where there was a rebellion, actually, that's the only armed rebellion we had in Zambia, and Adamson Mushala was a bandit, quote-unquote, supported by Pretoria and Vosta and South Africa. Anybody who challenged Kaunda would be labeled, although he had ties with apartheid South Africa. That was the only part you had in Zambia where you had armed rebellion.
Well, this is interesting because this is what Mugabe is now saying about anyone who stands against him. They must be sponsored by the West.
Absolutely.
The West, you know,
yes.
This nameless, shapeless
yes,
force.
There are always these enemies that you don't know.
Mm.
But also, this phase was the one that you saw Kaunda almost being deified, if I may use that word.
They started worshipping him.
Yes. You would have slogans at political rallies that would speak to the notion of Kaunda being the main representative here on earth for God, and upstairs, so to speak, was God himself. In the Bemba language, you would say Kumulu Lesa, upstairs in heaven, God. Mm. Panshi, meaning here on earth, Kaunda. And people would say, within the woods. And it would continue. And the slogans about Kaunda would be chanted in schools. Everybody had to be have a badge of UNIP.
It's like what they did with Hitler in Nazi
absolutely,
Germany.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So
and
we,
Stalin in Russia, yeah.
And that is the time we, the youth of the time, said, no, man, this can't go on. And we were like first year, second years at university. Our university group was the first one that began to look at issues of bread and butter. Our predecessors, they were always concerned about ideologies and the liberation movement.
Uh-huh.
We were the first to say, enough is enough.
So doesn't it feel like deja vu when you see what's happening here? Because now we've got that generation now at university.
Yes.
And we have
yes.
that generation now criticizing and revising the history
absolutely.
Of the liberation movement.
Absolutely.
We see a liberation movement ever more greedy for power and prominence and wealth.
Yes.
That are trying to make the hay while the sun shines, so to speak.
Yes.
Even though they know that it's slipping from them.
Well, there's actually an analysis about liberation movements.
Mm-hmm. Tell me.
The first 10 years will always be the 10 years of development.
Mm-hmm.
And the second decade of independence is the one where the rot sets in. Why? Because of the fact that everybody seems to have gone home to sleep.
Mm.
In South Africa, this country has been one of the mobilized countries I've ever been to
mm-hmm.
in terms of political consciousness.
Mm.
But after 1994, you find that political consciousness and the militancy that had galvanized the people of this country, and I dare say across all the race groups.
Mm.
Today, people are telling us about, it's only black people who fought for the... No. Let us not rewrite history. I remember many whites who died for the freedom struggle.
Well, I mean, there was that referendum in 1992 where white people were asked, listen, do you want to have a smooth transition into democracy where we have a vote for all or we don't?
Yeah.
And people kind of forget that was won quite resoundingly.
You know, and it's like the...
It's like the Brexit vote in Britain.
Absolutely.
While it may be an unpopular result,
yes,
this is how the people speak.
Yes. And there were colors who fought for the liberation of this country.
Absolutely.
There were even Indians who fought for the liberation of this country. So that militancy and that ability to get people together kind of waned after 1994.
It's almost like you've achieved the goal.
Yes, everybody goes, let's get on with our own lives. Yeah. And that's what we did also as a student movement. After we defeated Kaunda, we said, our job is done.
Yeah.
So building up the structures and enabling the democratic processes to continue once liberation was attained in most African countries was given to the ruling party or the governing party and say, here you are, take us to the promised land that you had been telling us all these years prior to independence. And that is the part of the 10 years. That after the 10 years, you find that most of these people become entrenched. They have clientelistic networks. They have patronage networks. And they begin to see themselves as the state and not as politicians who are supposed to provide the basis for change and to provide for the means for the citizens to have, services and other necessities.
We're talking to Ndangwa Noyo, who is from Zambia. We're talking about Zambian politics at the moment. It's his book that's just been released called Wrong Things About Africa. It looks critically in the mirror. But I think one of the reasons that maybe South Africa, and particularly the ANC in South Africa, have such an idealized view of Kenneth Kaunda and how his legacy in terms of that deification you spoke about continues here to some degree is because when 1991 rolled around and you had your first multi-party democracy elections, multi-party democratic elections since independence.
Yes.
When that was happening in your country, we were obviously in the middle of our own introspective revolution.
Yes.
And maybe we weren't actually watching. And the ANC certainly wasn't. The ANC was, at that point, they were focused firmly on the future and what they had to do as a party. So they took their eye off the ball in Zambia.
Yes, but
and they didn't see what was happening with their hero Kaunda.
Well, I think the ANC should have known better. The ANC should have known better because when these things were happening, when the society had rejected their president, the first founding president, their founding president, Kenneth Kaunda, the ANC was about to go back home.
Mm-hmm.
The ANC, when Zambia, the economy had imploded, and that's the third phase where the economy had basically imploded, where we had to queue for everything from mealie meal, all the basic essentials, medicine, etc. Mm. The economy was not functioning. The ANC was with us in Zambia. And it also was because of the fact that due to populist policies, we ended up with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank's prescriptions around our necks as nooses in terms of their structural adjustment program prescriptions, where the same development, the same gains that we had attained in the 1960s in terms of free quality education, healthcare was also free.
These were lost.
Were lost because of the fact that the ANC began to, the World Bank and the IMF began to call for the rolling back of the state in matters of social investment. And some of the issues that were unfolding at that time, the ANC were privy. And now this is where I would like to bring in the likes of Thabo Mbeki, who has been highly criticized in this country. Mbeki and his group were watching the fiasco unfolding in Zambia. And many ANC comrades at the time who I had interacted with always used to say to us, when we go back home, we won't have this fiasco. you understand? And so when we're having this, when you're having parts of the country getting into that kind of agenda setting, where chaos management begins to be the order of the day, you begin to ask yourself, why is South Africa taking this route? Because surely they should have seen what was happening.
It's almost as if you've got a play-by-play that you can watch and you can improve.
Yes.
You don't have to learn the same lessons.
You don't. You're just watching and you're saying, we won't do this, we won't do that.
Can I break from the actual chronology of Zambia's history for a second? What kind of a guy, because we also hear a lot about Julius Nyerere.
Yes.
And we hear a lot about Frederick Chiluba.
Yes.
What kind of men were these?
Let's start with
Nyerere.
Nyerere. His Swahili name was Mwalimu, the teacher. Mm-hmm. Brilliant man. Very humble. Mm-hmm. Incorruptible, I would say. Mm-hmm. And I would extend the argument that many of the experimentations around African democratic socialism that Kaunda tried in Zambia were actually copied from Nyerere.
But he took some guidance from Nyerere.
Absolutely,
while, right?
Absolutely.
And he should have listened to him when Nyerere told him it's time to go.
Took it to go. And I was coming to that because he gracefully, stepped down. But more importantly, Nyerere was a scholar. You know, had a PhD. You know, went to school and was able to play around with some of those philosophical, thrusts and ideologies and try to implement them in Zambia. In Tanzania. In Zambia, it was chaotic because Kaunda was just busy cutting and pasting and trying them out and forcing people to follow his so-called ideology, which really did not resonate with the material conditions in Zambia. And so that was one thing. If you said, look, this humanism is humbug, oh well, next day the OP will come and pick you up and you'll be gone. So Nyerere was part type of that type of leadership, I would say the quality leadership that Africa is lacking even now. Where a leader can be able to take criticism and be able to say, you know what, compatriots, I failed. I think let me pass.
Step aside.
Absolutely, the baton to the next generation. Now, when you look at Chiluba, Chiluba was a charismatic labor movement leader. When I was growing up, he was a firebrand. And wow! What a shaker for a short man to shake the whole nation, you know, little man, so to speak, but who was explosive, who had an atomic bomb, so to speak. And so for a long time, he was the voice of the people because the labor movement was very strong.
Right.
So I would say Chiluba also kind of followed the same path as Kaunda. He gets into power through the movement for multi-party democracy, which was a coalition of progressive forces, mainly championed by the students. Because without the students, if it wasn't for us, I don't think Zambia would have had that transition into multi-party democracy that it had at the time, at the crucial time. So Chiluba, at that crucial time, I would say
he played his part.
Well, he was not really a political force, so to speak.
Oh, right.
He was actually pulled into the process by certain segments.
He was an unwilling participant.
Thank you very much. And today, people want to rewrite that history. We have people like Akashamba Twambiku Sitaliwanika, a very strong academic, scholar, activist, Pan-Africanist, also part of the Barossa ruling elite class.
Yes.
But who transcended the tribal lines and galvanized Zambians around the question of multi-party democracy. He and his Marxist friend, Derek Chitala, were the founders of the movement for multi-party democracy.
Wow.
And those were youngsters. I think they were my age or slightly younger than me when they were driving that process. That's where the students were able to engage with them.
Dangwa, you make a very good case for academics, for people who are intellectuals. I mean, you said Nyerere was an intellectual. You mentioned Thabo Mbeki earlier. There's no doubt that he was far more an academic than he was a populist.
Yes.
you make the case that in the beginning, the first independent Zambian cabinet was a group of very educated people.
Very, very.
This is something we keep seeing, is that somehow, and I mean, Robert Mugabe is a tremendously well-educated man.
Absolutely.
But sometimes even they get it wrong. Even the educated class get it wrong, right?
We are only human beings.
Right.
We're only human.
Now, the greater theme of your book is something that I think applies not only to Zambia and to South Africa, but to a lot of countries on this continent.
Yes, to the rest of Africa.
Even north of the Sahara.
Absolutely.
Now, we want desperately, and the people of this continent want desperately to have success and to attain the levels of national stature and success that other countries all over the world have.
Absolutely.
India, China.
Yes.
I'm not comparing us with the old world. Let's say, you know,
right now.
Let's say, yeah.
In these material conditions, like you rightly pointed out.
We should be more relevant than we are.
Absolutely.
In the international scheme of things. We account for 8 to 10% of the world's population.
Yes.
We have young people in greater proportion to almost anywhere else in
Absolutely.
The world. We have people who are hungry for manufactured
yes.
goods, who are a market of them in and of themselves. We've
yes.
got the spread of mobile technology at the rate of knots.
Absolutely.
There is every reason why we should be successful. Why do our leaders disappoint us so much?
First and foremost, it's all about personal aggrandizement.
Yes.
So
greed.
So it's greed. So greed.
Because you actually use the term moribund.
Yeah.
You say
moribund.
Africa's moribund and shameless political
yes.
leaders.
I
mean,
yes.
you're not mincing your words.
No. Look, one is tired. Let's start with this situation whereby we have leadership that is amoral. They can do anything and they don't care. This leadership, I contend, is Africa's, Achilles heel. Mm-hmm. In the sense that, you rightly point out, when we started this journey of liberation, those who were in the forefront were the people who knew what needed to be done. And more often than not, they were the intellectuals. The teachers. Samora Machel in Mozambique was not just a rabble-rousing rebel movement leader. He was also, he went to school. He was
but
a nurse.
Wasn't Kaunda a teacher?
He was a teacher, yes, yes. In his limited way, he was a teacher. It might just sound like a bias, but yeah. The founder of Frelimo was Dr. Mondlane. An intellectual.
Yes.
In Ghana, it was Kwame Nkrumah who had several, academic credentials,
degrees, yeah.
PhDs, etc. You can count them. Why was it like that? It was because only those who went to school were able to stand up and challenge the colonialists one-on-one.
Mm-hmm. And stand their ground intellectually,
absolutely.
Academically, morally.
And morally.
Yeah.
You have people like Agostinho Neto, who was the first president, another doctor.
Mm-hmm.
You had in Guinea-Bissau, the leader, Amílcar Cabral, brilliant tactician, brilliant scholar, an agronomist. You had all these people that were educated being the force to reckon with and saying, this is where we want to go. Why is education important? Because education provides you a vision. It allows you the opportunity to project and say, 10 years from now, this is where we want to be. So you had visionary type of leadership that was not only anchored in education, but in a solid traditional foundation of Africa. And that's what we're lacking.
But when you have very smart people,
yes,
who are either the kind of people who have many, many degrees and are willing to take on the colonialists or the imperialists or the oppressive regimes
yes.
that used to exist in Africa, you can go one of two ways as those leaders.
Yes.
Because you either use your talents and your education and your intellectual capacities for good.
Yes.
As many of them
did.
Certainly. Yeah. And I'd say all of them started with those noble
yes.
ideals.
Yes.
But there is the temptation. Because so many of our fellow people on this continent are uneducated
yes.
or are poorly educated, there is the temptation to take from them,
yes,
to use them as a tool to maintain your own place in the hierarchy.
Yes, and some of those pitfalls did come to the fore.
And so good people might have turned bad.
Yes. I mean, Kwame Nkrumah, his last days were not so good.
Mm.
And that issue of taking a leader and making him into a demigod.
Because people are want all over the world to turn a country story into, oh, this is a bad country.
Yeah,
or this
yeah.
is a good country.
Yeah.
And there, in this continent, there is no such thing, because some countries have just never lived up to their full potential.
Never.
They've never been allowed to.
Absolutely.
Look at how Ghana is flourishing now.
Yeah. But you see, and that's the thing that we forget. And for me, I mean, I must raise this quite sharply. Is that, and you ask the question, why aren't we, the whole continent, why aren't we living to the fullest of our potential as individual countries on the continent with a resource base that is second to none?
And labor. We have people who need jobs. We have people who have skills.
Abundant labor. Yeah. And those things. Mm. But the issue is that we have not had a break from retrogressive political regimes. And that's why Zambia is marking time right now. And that's why Angola is marking time. Because Ghana, unfortunately, look, one does not want to preach bloodletting and all that. But when Jerry Rawlings came into power, he was a military ruler, but a revolutionary. And us, as youngsters, we looked up to Jerry Rawlings and Thomas Sankara. And he made sure that the old order was severed.
Start anew.
Absolutely. And this is the mistake we have made even in you know, many people talk about multi-party democracy. It's just people changing T-shirts from the old regime to another one. And they say,
sometimes the new regime just learns from the old
one. Yeah, from the old one.
Can I propose something here? Because your book is largely about us looking in the mirror. It's about us taking ownership of our own responsibility in respect of fixing our continent. But if there is any blame to be laid at the door of the West still, and I believe there is, I explain what it is from my point of view?
Yes.
I think there is something called the soft bigotry of low expectations.
Right, right.
And I borrowed that phrase from someone else. I can't remember who it is now. But what it reminds me is that all these Western regimes, the kind of bigotry that they display is not an overt one.
Yes.
They're not saying, oh, Africa's a bunch of simpletons.
Yes.
What they're doing is saying, oh, shame, let them rule themselves, which is almost like saying, you know, they're our pets.
Yes.
And well, when we leave the house, we leave the house in their charge. But you still treat them as your pets, not as your equals. And I would say the left in places like America and Europe almost do more damage by saying, Kaunda's the man that was elected. We must support him.
Yes.
Instead of supporting the people of that country, they want to be seen to be supporting the independent state and the liberation movement.
Yes, yes.
Which almost gives them a feeling of virtue signaling.
Yes.
They're able to say, well, look, we're friends with the African leaders.
Yes.
But we're not necessarily friends with the African people. Oh, but we send them aid.
Yes.
It's the soft bigotry of low expectation. We don't expect much more from them than to elect a dictator.
Yes.
That does not help, because it entrenches that dictator and it disempowers their people.
Absolutely.
And there's no recourse for them in the international community.
Yes.
Because the international community would rather have a semi-stable state of Zambia under the state of emergency and Kenneth Kaunda, which they did for many years.
For many years.
Than actually have the people in open dialogue with them as equals.
Yes. Look, it makes the West stand on a very strong platform to have mini chaos or even chaos on the African continent, so that they continue with the pillaging and looting of the resources.
Absolutely.
And it goes without saying.
And these leaders aid and abet
that
process.
They go and sign the deals.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at Francophone and how these multinationals like Total and the rest, and how they pillaged the oil resources of West Africa and Francophone states, and with the aiding and abating of the leaders, it brings tears to one's eyes. It tells us that, in fact, the position, the geopolitics that we have had in play do not allow for a progressive African, such as the likes of Lumumba or Thomas Sankara, to be at the helm, because you are challenging the geopolitical status quo, where Africa continues to be the conveyor belt where the resources are taken and then they're manufactured in Europe and then sent back to us. This type of arrangement, you know, still goes back to the mercantile era and the transatlantic slave trade. We, at that time, it was not the, the actual raw materials, but it was actually slaves, who were taken. And then the slaves would work in the plantations of the Caribbean and the southern parts of America and produce the cotton and the sugar that would go to build the industries of Liverpool. Which were precursors to the industries of Manchester.
Right.
Whereby, today we talk about Barclays Bank and everybody's running around, but Barclays, the Barclays brothers came to where they are today. Barclays Bank is where it is today because of slavery. They were slave owners and they sold human beings, and many of these Lloyds of London, etc., they came on the back of the slave trade. And today, it's not the human beings, but it's still the same type of arrangement. We're sending our resources. They are manufactured and sent back to us. It works for the West to have a bumbling fool as a leader for over an African country.
And for as long as possible.
Oh, yes. And if you have somebody who challenges, like Sankara, Lumumba, etc.
But then how does Mugabe get this reputation for being a challenger when, in effect, nobody cares? The fact is, the rest of the world actually don't care about him.
Well, Mugabe, you see, the problem here
is... Because he talks a good talk, right?
Yeah, that's it. But at the end of the day, do you see Mugabe really transforming his society and severing ties with the West?
Mm-mm.
You know,
no.
It's all about pacifying his masses. But when you look at the structure...
His new masters are just China.
They're China.
Yeah.
So what is the proposal? The proposal is that Africans should take charge of their destiny and begin to articulate an agenda that first says Africans first, in terms of who we are as a people and why we need to have good quality, high quality life in regard to what is transpiring in the society.
Flax, sorry, just come in here. I don't know if this thing's been recording.
Oh, my.
I've just looked at it now. I hope we just ran out of space or something, because it's not moving.
It should be. This is red. Let me call Greg.
Jesus, man. This is some conversation we're having here. I don't want to have lost any of this.
For God's sake. I mean, it's probably still going, but...
I just saw it now and I panicked.
Yeah, it's true.
This is fascinating. I mean, you see, you don't have to be just one of these things. And this is the problem again. Here in Africa, we look at everything simplistically. It's white, it's black.
It's black.
It's either you're pro Mugabe or you're pro the West.
You're Shona, you're Ndebele.
Right, can't just be a thoughtful individual.
Yeah, it's who I am. And I'm my main concern as a human being is to have a better Africa. Not on these silly stories we're being told that Africa is on the rise.
It's to pacify.
Yeah, to pacify.
And it's a kind of intellectual dishonesty.
Absolutely. And I think for me, the key issue was to begin to point out some of the things that we perpetuate in the name of Africanness that are retrogressive, that still make us the ridicule or the spectacles of the international community or anybody who wants to make us Africans look ridiculous.
Or make themselves look fantastic.
Fantastic, absolutely. So we perpetuate that ourselves. So an African who is incompetent and has been found wanting, the first thing is what? Especially in South Africa here, you know, you watch it. The first is a race card. Oh, it's because there was a racist. I can't stomach. I'm sorry. If you're incompetent, you're incompetent. I don't care whether you're black, white, yellow. But for us as Africans, we need to begin to say, let us have the best of us, represent us at every level. And this is what this book is all about. If we're talking about sports persons, men and women who go and represent various African countries at the Olympics, for example, let's have the best of our people who can go and represent us. But what do? We just, get a shoddy team and it goes and embarrasses us as African people. If we have politicians, let us have the best of our people. Technocrats, let's have the best of our people. I am saying, let the merit system reign in Africa. There's nothing wrong with the merit system because pre-colonial Africa was based on the merit system. Shaka Zulu would not have made that kingdom if he was not
the best.
The best. Yeah. Let us not lie to each other and distort Africa.
Forged a nation with, yes, the force of nature.
Absolutely. The cow horn formation and all those tactics, yeah, and strategies, military tactics were actually even copied by the West.
And let's not forget that those Zulu forces some years later defeated the world's most powerful army, the British.
The imperialists, the right. chief imperialists.
Who owned a quarter of the Earth's surface.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, for us, for somebody to be saying that, no, we're doing very well in Africa, when we have leaders such as Nguema in Equatorial Guinea, who has just appointed his yeah. son, who's a shady character, as vice president in preparation for him to be president. I mean, it says a lot about African people.
Look at Luanda, look at Angola. You've got DeSantos, he's running a family business.
All that oil. And these are the things that we need to interrogate as Africans to say, all that oil, you have people who are dying, lots of children dying in Angola from malaria, curable diseases. Where is the oil man going to? And then you have no hospitals. And that's why I say that. Yeah.
Can I ask you, because there's so much we could talk about yes. here, and I know we've been speaking for almost an hour already. Yes. It feels like 5 minutes.
Yes.
Dango, what do you think of the AU?
The African Union is toothless. Let us put it on the table. It is self-serving and it needs to be dismantled, and you need new leaders there that begin to articulate an agenda for the ordinary African, not for African presidents. We don't need that toothless organization. I'm stating this and I'm putting it on record. When the African Union, the Ebola crisis unfolded, I sat back and said to myself, oh, maybe the AU is coming. It took time for the AU to just begin to make a few noises here and there. When you have Nguema and Yoweri Museveni appointing his wife, beating up the main opposition leader and incarcerating him on trumped up charges, we don't hear anything from the African Union. And many of those bureaucrats there are self-serving. I must say. So, we need to dismantle that AU because it's still built on the old order of the Organization of African Unity, or AU. So, like I said, old orders still predominate in the new era. We just have change of names, but we don't have change of ideologies. We don't have change of tactics. We do not have change of personnel. New blood, passionate Africans. Who can drive the agenda of the continent? That's what we need.
What do you feel the climate is on campus here in South Africa, on the rest of the continent, where young intellectuals are being bred? What do you feel their arguments are? Are they more aligned to what you're saying, or do you think that they are the kind of arguments that support and entrench these systems which are not working for them?
Young people are restless, I would say. And restless in the sense that these are young people who are connecting with their peers on social media across the world. You have countries such as Denmark, mm-hmm. which were voted, I think, the happiest countries in the world. There's a happy index. Huh? Mm-hmm. There's a happy index somewhere out there. And these young people are tapping into that. Mm-hmm. And they're feeling that they are the dregs of the world community. You might have these gadgets, but they're seeing the lifestyles of their compatriots, of their colleagues across the peers. So they are restless. Then there's a disjuncture in the sense that you have the leadership, which is predominantly in the late 60s, 70s, even 90s in Zimbabwe, for crying out loud. You have a 92-year-old president. I don't know what he does, because I feel tired some days. And people say, and there's David Cameron. I mean, Cameron has resigned. And then we have got a new leader in the United Kingdom. And yet you still have a 92-year-old president with these young people in full force. But again, I also say the young people themselves who are restless, they should not channel their anger via social media. They should begin to mobilize like we did. We didn't even have social media, and we were in our early 20s at that time.
And you didn't have any of the means of communication.
No, we only had, you know, those flyers that you get, and then you make what's that ink?
Ronio machine.
Yes, and then and you do it clandestinely at night, so that you are not picked up, and you make those posts, and so many of them were just, you know, handwritten, and then you stick them up, and mobilize the masses. That's what we did. So I think the young people also need to rise to the occasion. I mean, when I look at what is happening in Zambia, it brings tears to my eyes, because we went into prison for this multi-party democracy. Gareth, it was not a joke. We were prepared to die. They picked me up at 4 o'clock in the morning at my dorm, at my hostel room. And you had something like 6 heavily armed guys coming to your door. And you ask yourself, for only all little me? Are they coming just for this little guy? 7, with a superintendent with his pistol in its holster. And 6 young guys, paramilitary, with AK-47s. And pick me up. And I'm like, wow. And they had all my details, my student number, etc. So they had done their homework, these guys. The intelligence system was very strong. They were not just picking people any old how, you know. So we did that for them. And today you only have the youth who are being used as cannon fodder for politicians who have paid them a bit of money here and there. And then they're busy beating up each other. Would they have stood up to the mighty Kaunda like we did? These young Zambians who are being used by politicians of today, the same multi-party democracy that we fought for as young people. No. They have to rise up to the occasion. I mean, we almost died. These guys were shooting at us with live ammunition. They couldn't care less. They were protecting Kaunda and his one-party state dictatorship. But we said no. When I look back, I shudder. I don't know how I was. I asked myself, where did I get that courage? Because if it was today, I don't know.
Well, you know, all over this continent, there are young people who... And I sometimes feel like I'm among them. We don't entirely appreciate the sacrifices of generations that have come before. And when we do, we must not find ourselves beholden to that.
Not
but so. We must improve on that.
Absolutely.
And I so appreciate this book. I would encourage anyone who feels that they are a proud African, who feels that they want to make a contribution to an Africa where all of us can make a difference.
Thank you very much.
This is the kind of book that they should read. Called Wrong Things About Africa. And Ndangwa Noyo, thank you so much for coming to see us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. CliffCentral.com.